Marco satellites will follow InSight all the way to Mars for the next 6 months. And when InSight separates from its cruise stage and that solar panel and everything separates from that, from the landing stage, and that goes through the, through EDL, entry, descent, and landing, which is roughly 8 minutes, InSight will, you know, it's got a heat shield on it. It's got to slow down from 14,000 miles per hour, and it's got a parachute on it, and then eventually the parachute will separate. The heat shield will be separated, and it will be all by itself. It's got 12 little rockets on the bottom, and it's going to do a propulsive landing, and it's going to land roughly near the equator of Mars. Now, we've done this many times before. We've had successful landings of vehicles that have gone to Mars, and some of the telemetry always gets sent back to Earth, and usually almost real time. They have the Deep Space Network looking at Mars at the time, and there's a constant carrier coming out of these landers. But it's possible that, you know, we might not get that signal because the antenna might be facing one way or the other, or as it's going through the atmosphere, it might have some problems. And they would like to know the status of every spacecraft before it lands. So they have orbiting satellites. In the past, we've used these orbiting satellites to pick up the signal as these spacecraft are going down, landing on Mars. And eventually, it's a store and forward type of system. They'll send the information to, let's say, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, one of the orbiters. And then, after a while, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter would send the signal back on, you know, to the Deep Space Network, and we would know whether or not the spacecraft landed safely on the planet. But sometimes, depending on orbital mechanics, that satellite might have to go all the way around Mars, and it might take you a couple of, you know, an hour or two before they get the results. They would like to know real time. And one of the ways that they're going to do it is with these Marco satellites that are following it. Marco satellites are true transponders. They you know, on a cross-band situation. They're going to be receiving the signals from InSight as it goes down through the atmosphere and lands on UHF. And then it will be retransmitted to Earth using this X-band. If you look at the satellites, it's this mesh setup. It's a flat mesh reflector. And that's going to be sending it back real-time on X-band. And at the time, it will be picked up by Madrid, Spain. We have three main antennas on Earth. We have one in Madrid, Spain, another one in Australia, in Canberra, and then another one in Goldstone, California. So NASA has three main dishes that are looking at that. There's a lot more dishes than that, but they're locations, and they'll pick up the signal either directly from the lander as it goes through, and if they don't get that, they'll get the signal from Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that's orbiting Mars. On a store and forward basis, or they're going to maybe get it through these one or both of these cube satellites that are following InSight all the way in. CubeSats have become very popular on Earth. There's probably almost 800 that have been launched from different rockets over, you know, since the late 1990s. And you could have different size CubeSats. Each CubeSat is roughly a 10 centimeter cube. And that would be called just a 1U unit. You could have two of these, and they could be together, two, three. Well, the Marco satellites are six. They're called a 6U or 6 unit So it's like having six cubes together, about the size of a briefcase, around 30 pounds. And it's got a transmitter on board. It's got little thrusters that, gas fired thrusters. They don't really ignite, but there's eight little thrusters, and they all come out of one tank. So there's a manifold that feeds these eight little thrusters, and that's, how they can maneuver in space. The attitude could be changed because they have reaction wheels on board, three different reaction wheels. This way they could change their attitude. They could pitch your, or roll. And so they also have the ability to look at the stars. They look at the stars, and they can tell what stars they're looking at, what constellations they're looking at. And that feeds into the computer, and it knows which way it's facing in space. They're very advanced, and they've gotten signals back successfully from both Marco satellites and from InSight. So, in about 6 months, actually the day after Thanksgiving will be the day that this thing will be landing on Mars. So we'll be looking forward to that. And we'll talk more about EDL at that time, entry, descent, and landing, and whether or not this thing works out. On board, it has capability of looking for what's called the Mars quakes, not really earthquakes, but Mars quakes. It's got a seismometer on there, very sensitive. That's the one that they had to fix. That's the reason they couldn't launch 2 years ago. And then they have this other probe that's going to pound its way into the surface, and they really call it a mole. And by watching the news conference that they had, I finally saw a video of on the inside of this thing, how this thing works, and it was pretty interesting, but the video told it all. It's kind of got like a motor inside that turns, and it has this cam inside, and it pushes up on a cam, and the cam is pushing against the spring, and eventually gets to the point where it falls off the cam, and this weight now gets, due to the spring, forces itself forward and hits the nose of this mole. And this happens every 3 seconds. It'll be hitting this thing, and it's going to pound its way into the surface, and this is going to take a long time, like probably a couple of weeks before it gets all the way down to 15 feet. That's, they'll be happy if it goes between 3 meters and 15 meters into the surface. And what they're going to do is take the temperature on the way down. And the way they do that is, it's not like they have a thermometer on this thing, but what they're going to do is, it's going to give off heat. As it gives off heat, and the amount of time it takes to cool around the thermometer, that's how they're going to tell how hot the or cold the surface is of whatever depth they're at. So that's the story on InSight and the Marco satellites. Let me drop it. It's actually been a very busy week. Dragon has made a return. That's SpaceX cargo vehicle. It's been up to the International Space Station before, and now this one's gone up again. SpaceX has a goal of recycling everything. The boosters, most people know that they're very successful in returning the boosters. Well, the Dragon space cargo vehicle, too, unless I guess four of them that went up have gone up before. So it's kind of like the space shuttle. We set the space shuttle up and kept sending it up over and over again. That's what SpaceX is doing with the Dragon cargo vehicle. It brought up about 6,000 pounds of stuff. And then over the last month or two, they loaded it up and brought stuff back on the cargo vehicle. And it landed successfully in the Pacific Ocean. It was supposed to do this a couple of days ago, but due to the weather, high seas, it was delayed a little bit. So it landed in the Pacific Ocean on Saturday as well, around 3:30 in the afternoon. And they brought all kinds of science stuff back. But what I was interested in that they brought back is the Robonaut 2, they call it. Robonaut 2 is a robot. He looks like a regular robot that, you know, you would find in a science fiction show. He's got a head, his arms, torso. And he was built by General Motors. And he was sent up there around 2011. And they had some problems with him. They were having trouble getting him working properly. They finally got some kind of results out of it. So they sent up legs. They had only sent the torso, arms, and a head. So they finally sent the legs up. They went to attach that, and they had all kinds of problems. Things just didn't work out. So the last 7 years or so, it's been pretty much in storage. They take it out once in a while to try to repair it or make it work with help from the ground, from Houston. But they kind of gave up. So they took Robonaut 2, put him on the Dragon spacecraft, and sent it back to Earth. And he's going to go back to the drawing board. And maybe someday in the future, they'll find out what the problems are. And I mean, I have read a little bit about it. It looks like they've got some kind of big-time grounding problem. Chassis ground type of thing. And whatever they're doing, things aren't working. Everything's shorting out. So Robonaut 2 didn't work out. They had a lot of high hopes for them. They were eventually going to use them to do EVAs, and, you know, replace an astronaut to do things. Still on the drawing board, but probably many years from now. Story of that. I did want to talk about Blue Origin. Blue Origin is another company that's striving to have reusable spacecraft. Their goal is to also use reusable spacecraft. They had a successful launch last week. They launched from Texas, and this is it's called the New Shepard. The New Shepard is this is their third iteration. The first one that they built, when they tested it, went up once and was kind of successful in landing, but then the second one didn't work out. The second flight didn't work out. But the last one that they built, the last New Shepard, was very successful. It went up and landed like 5 different times successfully. But now they retired that one, and they built this new one. This new one has an actual crew spacecraft on top. In fact, they put a big mannequin in there. And this is the second flight for this particular iteration. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket, capable of taking up to 6 people to suborbital flights. So probably within a year, you'll be able to buy a ticket, go down to West Texas, train for a day or two. They'll put you on this rocket. You'll do a suborbital flight to get above the Kármán line. The Kármán line is 100 kilometers, so roughly 62 miles. And this thing, in fact, this one went around 65, 68 miles up. On the way down, you're not attached to the booster anymore. On the way down, you're coming down on a spacecraft. You separate from the booster, and these parachutes open up. You come down to the desert in Texas, and right at the last second, they have little rockets that ignite to slow your descent, and you're supposed to land safely. The rocket itself flies all the way back and comes down vertically, and it doesn't come back to the exact landing spot, but it comes very close to it. And the idea is to bring this back to the hangar, and be able to bring it out again within a day and do this over and over again. So that's their goal. And I expect the crew will probably, you know, test flight with somebody on this probably within, I'm going to say, by the end of the year. Maybe they'll do that maybe by the end of this year. This is WS2N. So quite a few more things here, Dick, but I don't want to keep going on and on. But they're the main topics. You know, there's other things we could talk about. Foreign flights. China, I know, is going to be launching this month. They'll be launching a spacecraft to the moon. Very interesting flight. And then at the end of the year, another spacecraft will be going to the moon in coordination with that flight. And that's going to have a rover on it, and it's going to it's going to land. Not, you know, talk about which side that you could see. It's going to land on the opposite side, toward the dark side of the moon. I know it's not dark there, but first time anything's going to land there, and they're going to land it with a rover. That's China. So if you want to talk about that later, you can. Any questions, comments? This is WS2N. Turn it back to you, Dick, for anything at this time.
Paul, awful glad that the InSight had a very nice launch. From Vandenberg, in your opinion, what made them choose Vandenberg for launch as opposed to Cape Canaveral, Canaveral Space Center? Usually when Vandenberg is used, it's because they want to launch a polar orbit. Well, when you're going toward Mars, you don't start off with a polar orbit. So maybe for some reason they wanted to, it's more convenient to do a launch on the West Coast. But as far as the azimuth angle of the spacecraft leaving the Earth and getting the advantage of Earth rotation, in order to get advantage of Earth rotation from Vandenberg, you'd have to launch to the east, which means you'd be launching over Earth. So if anything went wrong, you'd be running into habitable areas. So in your opinion, why did they choose Vandenberg for InSight? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, what they decided on was because of the busy manifest going on in Florida. Look at all these flights that SpaceX is doing. The United Launch Alliance, with all the Atlas flights, and even Orbital ATK had a flight not too long ago. Plenty of action in Florida right now. And they knew that. And in fact, they knew it 2 years ago when they were planning the launch. So they have a spacecraft, InSight, weighing around 800 pounds, less than 1,000 pounds. So it's on the light side. Even so, when it opens up, it's got big solar panels that open up when it gets to Mars. In fact, if you were to open it up and stand next to it, it's 21 feet long. So, I mean, it does look big when it's all opened up. But it's light. Curiosity is a little over 2,000 pounds. This thing's under 1,000. So they knew they could launch and go south. In fact, it was slightly retrograde when they launched. And then it goes around once around the Earth. And when it got to its apogee, and at the time I believe it was over Texas, they reorient the second stage, the Centaur second stage boost, reoriented, and essentially make a left-hand turn. You know, they launch south, going around Antarctica, and they come up around the other side, and as they come around the Earth, and as they're coming back down south again, they essentially make a left-hand turn. They turn that vehicle to pretty much to the left. I think it was like 60. They started off around 62 degrees inclination, and then, you know, wound up actually dead zero when they did make that turn, and then headed off to Mars. So it had to do with the manifest, and they have that capability to launch from Vandenberg.
When they lost, when when they left the ground at Vandenberg, what azimuth angle did the launch go up, Paul? You gave a number and it didn't seem to make sense. In order not to have the launch over habitable areas, it would be somewhere between south, southwest, south, northwest, and maybe almost north. But in order to miss habitable areas from Vandenberg, you're almost launching out over the Pacific Ocean, which is opposite as the direction of Earth rotation is concerned. So you're giving up the advantage of Earth rotation when you launch from Florida and you launch to the east. So that's a considerable disadvantage as I see it. And that left-hand turn you talked about, that uses up a lot more thrust, if you know what I mean. So they must have had some extra thrust to be able to do this. ODU Paul, K2RAW.
Yeah, like I said, Atlas V was, you know, that launched Curiosity, which was around 2,000 pounds, to Mars, and they did that from Florida, so they had the extra push of the Earth in that case. They didn't need that here with the 700-pound vehicle. So, no problem with that. In fact, they didn't use solid boosters. You could attach 5 solid boosters onto an Atlas V. Like, you could have a, you know, that would be a 5 meter diameter fairing, and then you could have 5 boosters, and that one would stand for that one engine, that Centaur upstage. Eventually there's going to be 2 engines on that. So they had plenty of power. They didn't need any extra boosters. So, yeah, they went due south. If you look at the globe where Vandenberg is, it's just north of Los Angeles. And you if you go, like, directly south, you're just going to view parallel the coast of Los Angeles. That's why the people could see it. If I'm standing in L.A., I'm going to see it go from my right to the left. And it's heads down, due south, you know, right, you know, following the coast all the way down to Antarctica. So I think it's 62 degrees, he said they started out at. And you go all the way around, not directly off the pole of Antarctica, but, you know, off, you know, not quite. So it's roughly a polar orbit. For argument's sake, but when it comes all the way around again, when it gets up to its apogee, that's the point where it's, you know, kind of like floating. They're able to turn that whole vehicle and kind of make a left, and that's the way the guy on the news conference described it. He's in charge of the United Launch Alliance Atlas V. Back to you, Dick.
When you said the launch angle was 62 degrees, I presume you're talking about an azimuth angle, and I think you're talking, and usually those angles are measured with reference to true north. 62 degrees from true north would be to the northeast. If they launch from Vandenberg to the northeast, they'd be launching over a habitable area. I'm with you. I think they launched from Vandenberg almost due south. That's very close to 180 degrees true bearing. Back to you, Paul, K2RAW.
Oh, okay, I get. I know what you're saying. No, 62 degrees, I'm calling that inclination. And, you know, they always give these degrees when they launch from Florida. It's usually 22.5 degrees inclination. They do a polar launch from Florida, they can only go up so far up to, I think, 68 degrees when they can't used to come up north here. That's what I'm talking about in relation to the equator.
Okay. Now, I am guessing that InSight, similar to, it's going to be doing a entry and landing. ENG, you know what I mean, those 3 letters. It's a very heavy craft. So how come they didn't need extra boosters? the total aircraft, which I think is the inside plus the two CubeSats, isn't that total mass a pretty big number, Paul? Go ahead.
No, not at all. Give you an idea, Curiosity, that's the heaviest thing that we've ever landed on Mars. It's just over 2,000 pounds. This was, it's under 1,000, I think it was almost 800 pounds. The CubeSats themselves, you know, they're only the size of a suitcase, and they weigh about 32 pounds, I think I read 32 pounds. So they came with the interesting thing, they had batteries on it, and they were all packed away and on the spacecraft in March, and they just hoped that they had enough power, these lithium-ion batteries, to, you know, which, at launch, these things get shot out of the back of this, the back of the second stage, and they had to have enough power to open up their solar panels, and then right after that, open up their X-band reflector, which opened up kind of like a brochure, you know, old-time map that you have in your car, you know, a couple of little bends, and everything is spring-loaded. In fact, the I'm going to call the feed horn, that was also spring-loaded. That popped up, and then out of the bottom, another thing popped, pushed down. That was the UHF antenna. So the UHF antenna and the X-band are set at 90 degrees from one another purposely, because when you get to Mars, InSight's going to be on the ground or close to it, and this thing's going to be coming directly over it. So the UHF is going on the bottom of the satellite, picking it up, and then 90 degrees from that, this X-band is going to be sending the signals back to Earth. So they're only 30 pounds each, so you look at a total, you know, 800 pounds. That's
repeater, timeout.
800 pounds, I timed out.
Yeah, how'd you know you timed out? Are you listening to the output of the repeater, Paul?
No, I just unkeyed and I heard timeout. And I got all, well, everything's disconnected here. I'm remodeling a little bit, so I had to put Humpty Dumpty back together again for tonight. Back to you, Dick.
Now, in the case of the InSight, he's got a real heat shield. He's going to hit the atmosphere, slow down a certain amount, deploy a parachute, slow down some more, and then use rocket power as a space crane, I'm guessing, very similar to the way Curiosity did its landing. And I'm guessing InSight is going to do one of those. In the case of the CubeSats, I don't think they contain a heat shield, a parachute. So what puts the CubeSats in orbit? Paul, go ahead.
No, they just have gas thrusters on there. I have a chemical name somewhere. But it's just, they don't ignite when the thrusters come off. So they have no power to go into orbit. They're going to go into a heliocentric orbit. It's a flyby for them. So it's a one-shot deal. After they do fly by, they will send the information back again, back to Earth, just in case something went wrong, and it's like a backup system. But essentially, after receiving and transmitting, acting like a transponder for these things, they're going to be gone. In the future, they plan on putting SEP rocket systems on it. SEP is solar electric propulsion system, and then if they ever do that, then they would eventually wind up slowing down to go into orbit. So they're not going to do that. As far as InSight goes, no, it's not going to have a sky crane. If you remember back in 2007, it was launched, and 2008 landed something called the Phoenix lander. The fact that it kind of looks like this. It's designed, the same kind of design as Phoenix, which is done for a reason, because it was very successful. So, it eliminates a lot of chance. They don't want chance. The Phoenix landed on the North Pole, same type of thing. Came through the atmosphere, had a heat shield. Heat shield separated. Eventually, the back shield separated after the parachute did its job. And then you had this flying thing coming down, flying little bedspring, and it has 12 rockets on it, and that slows itself down and comes to a landing. Let me drop it. Since I was so successful, they're doing the same thing here with InSight. Through the atmosphere, 14,000 miles an hour, slow it down to, it'll be going faster than the speed of sound. When the parachute pops open, this parachute happens to be stronger. They have stronger connections between the spacecraft and the parachute for a number of reasons. It's a little heavier unit than Phoenix was. It's coming through at a little faster speed, and also it's going to land at a higher altitude. Let me drop it. Phoenix landed in more of a valley, so that had more atmosphere to slow its descent with the heat shield. This one doesn't have that capability, so it needs to have stronger parachutes, a little bit bigger too. So when it comes down, the back shell separates, with the parachute, and it's just this spacecraft coming down. It does have 12 engines on the bottom. It's got 3 landing legs, and that's how it's going to land. It doesn't have that sky crane system that Curiosity had. The next one that goes up, the next Curiosity, 2 years from now, that'll have that sky crane set up. K2RIWWS to end.
If I understand correctly, the CubeSats are going to be acting as relay stations, picking up some signals from InSight and relay them back to Earth. And if the CubeSats just separated from the InSight by a couple of feet, since the InSight is going to be hitting the atmosphere and using its heat shield to do the first stage of slowdown, the CubeSats would be hitting the atmosphere also. Obviously, that's not done. So I am guessing the CubeSats are going to separate from InSight long before it hits Mars. They're going to be separating and thrusting themselves in a particular direction that they do a flyby of Mars but miss Mars. So in order to get maximum performance out of the CubeSats, let me drop. I'm guessing they're going to separate from InSight, thrust themselves in a direction slightly away from Mars so that they do a flyby of Mars, and also thrust themselves so that they arrive at Mars later. You don't want the CubeSats to go whizzing by Mars and they're a million miles away from Mars at the time that InSight is doing its actual landing on the surface. So you want the CubeSats to arrive away from Mars as a flyby and arrive late. So I'm guessing they do an early separation and they do a thrust that slows down their rate at which they approach Mars. Am I even close to right on this one, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
You're right in the sequence, but you're way off as far as timing goes. They've already separated. They launched yesterday morning, and they've already separated. You got to understand the way that this Centaur, second stage, this thing's 30, 40 feet long, that second stage. And at the front of that second stage, that's where you have the InSight vehicle with the cruise stage. That's way in the front. As this thing is on the way to Mars, and by the way, they have it angled slightly away from Mars, when InSight separates. So InSight separates, and then attached to the back end, where the engine is, on this Centaur upper stage, that's where they have these two 30-pound Marco satellites. One separates, and then it turns 180 degrees, and then the other one separates. now it's now these two Marcos are now right now following InSight. InSight's already way ahead of these two things. This spacecraft will be entering. It takes what, 8 minutes to get down to the surface. So that tells me that Marcos will probably be at least 8 minutes behind, maybe 10-15 minutes behind, to pick up the signal as that thing is going down. This thing will be directly above it. They show a diagram. In other words, the InSight will be wind up on Mars at that time when it's on Mars. Straight down. That's where the CubeSats will be looking straight down at it, and then because the antennas are 90 degrees offset. That offset will be looking back at Earth. They have it figured out pretty good. That's the idea. They have their own propulsion systems, their own guidance systems in these mini suitcase size satellites. I find them fascinating. And there's going to be a lot more of these. If these are successful, they're going to plan on using these things quite a bit in the future. Like I said, they're very successful. CubeSats are like 700 or 800 have been launched so far around Earth. This is the first group to leave Earth as far as a CubeSat goes. There's 13 more planned on the first SLS mission that will eventually go out to the moon. The first SLS mission is uncrewed. That's the Space Launch System. But, that's eventually going to have, Orion space astronauts on board. When that first gets tested and sent to the moon, on board, again, attached to the inner stage, is going to be 13 of these satellites that are going to do all kinds of stuff. In fact, I think one of them might be some kind of a lander. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so the CubeSats have already separated, if I understand correctly. And they're on a trajectory. I'm guessing they're going to do a flyby of Mars and then go into solar orbit. And I presume you want them to arrive at Mars later than InSight. Are they going to arrive at Mars, let me pick a number, a half hour later or something like that? I'm guessing the main reason the CubeSats are being used is it gives you communication using the hardware that relays a weak signal from InSight up to the CubeSats. The CubeSats relay it back to Earth. And now, because you've got your own relay system along with InSight, you have got complete freedom. You can arrive at Mars anytime you want to. Let me drop. Ordinarily, when you've got a spacecraft on the surface of Mars, it communicates back to Earth, either directly to Earth with a very weak signal, that means a very low data rate, or you transmit a fast data rate up to one of the satellites we've got in orbit around Mars. However, those orbits have got their own individual timing. That would mean that your window of InSight arriving at Mars would have to be very carefully timed so that you've got a satellite in orbit in the right place at the right time to really relay the information about how the injection and landing is going, and therefore you might be missing a whole lot of information. By having your own relay satellites by the CubeSats going with InSight, you're guaranteed to have the communication during that critical phase of atmospheric re-entry. Is that roughly what's going on? So two questions now. How much later do the CubeSats arrive at Mars? And is the main reason that you've got complete freedom now that you can arrive at Mars with InSight anytime you want to because you're bringing your own relay satellites? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, because EDL is roughly 8 minutes, so my guess is the Marco satellites probably would be ideally probably 10 minutes behind. This way, as it's going through, and then eventually lands. After it lands, you want they'd like to have Marco right above it. If you look straight up on Mars, you would like to be able to see Marco right above. Both Marcos. And so it's probably 10, 12 minutes, something like that. The idea of silliness. Yeah, like the one that we use a lot is the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's a big satellite. I mean, this thing is massive. So, you know, it's the size of a Winnebago flying around Mars. And it has great capability. It can receive all the UHF, you know, from all the landers that are down there and sends it back on, usually on X-band. But it can't do the same, it can't do it at the same time. It's not set up to work as a real repeater, as a true cross-band repeater. It's not picking up UHF and sending it back on X-band. But these Mako satellites are designed for exactly that. So it's going to be coming up at 8 kilobits per second from UHF from the ground, hitting the Mako satellite, and then they're going to turn around and send it back on X-band at, again, 8 kilobits, you know, per second. And that's what Madrid will be picking up on the Deep Space Network. Now, true, like what you said, the Deep Space Network will also be listening to the UHF signal from the lander. That's what they always try to do. And that's how you usually know right away. If that doesn't work, if it's not, you know, aligned right or whatever, you have the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter right above. And by the way, they've adjusted the orbit of that to time it just right so that the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter will be in a proper location. So by doing that, that will be picking up the same UHF signal from inside as it goes down, but it does not have that capability. It's not a true cross-band repeater. So that will continue around the planet, and then later on, another hour or so, when it comes out around Mars, then it will transmit that information back. They'd have to wait that extra time to get the results. Here they get the results right away. In the future, if this works out so good, they might say, you know what, let's leave Mars Reconnaissance alone. Leave it in its present orbit. We won't need it. And let it do its science, and we'll just use CubeSats if this works out very good. You know, they'd have that capability, not only for this mission, but, you know, planetary missions to Jupiter or Saturn. So that's the idea of that. And if this doesn't work out, this is really a proof of concept type of deal. It's the first time CubeSats have left Earth orbit, and they want to see how they do. Right now, they're doing phenomenal. Got a good report from NASA.
Paul, if the CubeSat is being used as a relay device between the InSight insertion and landing, and is relaying the information in real time back to the Deep Space Network, if that's the main function of the CubeSat, why are there two of them? Wouldn't one do the job? Over to you, Paul.
That's redundancy. That's all that is, you know. Two is better than one, so that's pretty good. Now, the lander also has X-band capability. In fact, one of the things that they, you know, this InSight has is they're going to be able to tell exactly where that spacecraft is. They're going to send a signal directly back to Earth. Forget about the CubeSats for now. Once this thing lands, it's got two horns sticking out of it, one facing east and one facing west. By the way, this thing has to land east and west. It's good. When it comes down, it's going to orient itself. It wants to be east and west for a good couple of reasons that I'm running out of time. But, you know, just like we send a signal up to Voyager, and we know exactly how far Voyager is, you know, within, you know, maybe a foot or so. Same thing with InSight. And they're going to be able to know exactly how far that is away. And they want to be able to take measurements as this thing, as that planet turns. And by doing that, they'll know exactly which way the pole, the North Pole and the South Pole, is facing exactly to, you know, to a real fine degree. And by having that information, they'll be able to tell what's inside the core of the planet, how molten is it, how much liquid is in it, how much, you know, lava is floating around inside the mantle. All the scientists will love this information. But to do it, they need to have this thing land a certain way, east and west. By the way, using the same X-band, they're also going to be able to, since they know where that vehicle is at every second, if something strikes Mars, the seismometer will be able to pick up that signal. And then later on, as this wave penetrates the planet and it comes back and penetrates and hits the seismometer again, they'll know exactly how much the planet has moved, and they'll be able to tell. That gives them, it's almost like having two or three different seismometers on the planet. They'll be able, by using that information and all the math that goes behind it, they'll be able to tell where this signal originated, you know, how fast it moved through the planet, all kinds of stuff, all with RF. RF is doing one heck of a job with these satellites, that's for sure. Back to you, Dick.
RF is good stuff. That's what we're preaching. RF is your friend. RF radiation is your friend. It's not your enemy. A lot of people misunderstand that. By the way, the fraction of the surface that can be seen by a spacecraft at Lagrange Point number 2, a million miles away from the Earth, that fraction of the Earth that you can see is called a segment. Mathematically, it's called a segment. And so once you know the angles involved, the 3956 is the radius of the Earth, and you compare that to a million miles for where the spacecraft is that you're talking about, Lagrange Point number 2, that's a ratio of 252 to 1. And so that angle turns out to be, if it was ideal, it would be 89 degrees, but it's, 90 degrees, it's 89.77. The bottom line, how much area does a segment have compared to a hemisphere? And the answer is, you can see 49.8% of the Earth from a million miles away. 49.80% is the mathematics on that one, Ron Paul. And, by the way, next week, Roy, let me drop it. I'm pretty sure Roy is going to continue with his discussion on the International Space Station. We found out tonight that everybody thought this 30, 40, 50, 90% of the Earth's surface can be seen from the International Space Station. It's really 3%. Next week, he's going to discuss the gravity characteristics. How come the astronauts sense microgravity, or essentially no gravity? They call it weightlessness. Why is there weightlessness on the International Space Station? To many people, the answer to that is a surprise, different than common sense. Okay, we've used up our time. You heard Space Report number 298. You heard Science and Physics Report number 28. You've heard the TechNet number 1698. We'll be back next week. 73, you all. I made a guess as to what your next puzzle is going to be next week. A little bit of it. Am I even close on that one, Roy? AC2GS for a final. K2LIW in the TechNet.
You got it on the nose, Dick. That's going to be next week, and it'll lead to other discussions about gravity. Fascinating, a little confusing, and what have you. Also, for anyone who doubts the Monty Hall problem, I found the site. If you go to Monty2.ac2gs.com, there's a very nice simulator for the Monty Hall problem. You can run it 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, and see how the probabilities turn out for you doubters out there. And I just want to thank Dick and thank Paul and thank everyone who participated tonight. It was loads of fun for me. I hope it was fun for you guys, and I'll see you next week.
Okay, let me see if I have it. And, Roy, your mailbag is mailbag at ac2gs.com. Is that true?
Yes, it is. You could probably send anything at ac2gs.com and I'll get it, but I would prefer if people label it mailbag at ac2gs.com, so I'll keep it all straight in one file.
Okay, I sent something over to you that somebody sent to me, mostly tech questions, really probably for Dick, so you should have gotten that. Just hope that works. 73, Roy.
73, Paul. Yes, I got it. No problem.
Bye-bye, you guys. Ham radio is supposed to be fun. Try to enjoy it. Don't get angry at it. Be kind to each other. K2RIW clear.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73. And good night from the W2VL.